You're listening to Civic from the San Francisco Public Press. On this edition, an environmental policy analyst lays out why buildings ought to transition away from using gas.
So before gas even reaches you and before you even burn it to cook or to heat anything, it's leaking throughout the pipeline system. It's leaking at pilot holes and compressors and all along the infrastructure. And when it leaks into the atmosphere, the life cycle emissions and the climate impacts of gas are a lot worse. And sometimes they can outweigh the pollution impacts from coal and oil even. Of course, there's also the air pollution impacts of burning gas, especially the important impacts of burning gas indoors, burning them inside homes near to where people live.
I'm Laura Wenis, and this is Civic. Cities are moving toward building electrification as part of efforts to reduce emissions. As we'll talk about today, a significant portion of greenhouse gas emissions are linked to buildings where we live and work. So as the Pacific Northwest endures a deadly climate change-induced heat wave, and since news recently broke in San Francisco that there's been a potentially dangerous practice of encasing gas lines in concrete during seismic retrofits, we wanted to take a closer look at what it means to use gas in buildings. I talked with Sasan Sadat, a research and policy analyst with Earth Justice. One of his focus areas is transitioning energy, building, and transportation systems away from fossil fuels. Several California cities have decided that future buildings shouldn't have gas lines at all and should be fully electrified. And I'm hoping that you can start by talking a little bit about why that is and why you're working on a campaign to basically get fossil fuels out of buildings.
There's multiple reasons. I'll start sort of with the climate reason. So most people know that to, you know, tackle climate change, we need to stop using fossil fuels. And I think folks, you know every day in their homes, they use gas and electricity. And we've been told, you know, from early on, you got to turn off the lights when you leave the room, reduce your energy use. And that's definitely important. But that only kind of reduces your electricity sector side, which actually, thanks to the lowering costs of solar and wind energy and the decline of coal, our electricity is actually moving closer and closer to zero emissions. So we're getting to a place where the electricity that powers our homes and our buildings is on its way, definitely not close enough, fast enough, but on its way towards being clean and zero carbon and zero emission. But on the gas side, there's really nothing we can do about that. That's sort of like a stubborn portion of the emissions in our buildings that We can be more efficient, try to reduce our use, but ultimately too many things in our homes, namely heating, hot water, and cooking, rely on gas. And so because we have appliances that can do those things much more efficiently and much more low cost using electricity, we want to make sure that any new buildings we construct that are going to be standing for a really long time don't have gas in them and instead rely just on electricity so that we can, you know, transition them to zero emissions over time.
Earth Justice and the Sierra Club worked on this report about gas in buildings. And one of the figures in that report is that 40% of climate pollution in the United States comes from buildings, which is a little bit shocking, I think, every time that I see it. And I know that we've talked about this before, but can you break that down? What goes into that 40%?
You know, building emissions covers a lot of stuff. Like it sometimes, depending on how you draw it, it includes the built materials of the buildings, the concrete and the cement. It can include, like I said, the energy use of the building, which is what people mostly focus on. And so energy use in buildings covers, like I said, electricity and gas. The easiest, most, you know, low cost, simplest way to reduce emissions from the energy use of buildings is to A, use energy more efficiently, so lower your energy usage, and B, to use cleaner sources of energy, namely solar and wind power and other renewable sources of energy. But because we don't have renewable energy sources for the gas side, at least not sufficient renewable energy sources for the gas side, we need to migrate as many energy uses in buildings over to electricity as possible so that as we clean up our grid, we're at the same time cleaning up our buildings.
So in a different report from Earth Justice, I'm hoping you could just clarify these numbers for me. I'm seeing the statistic that building emissions are responsible for a quarter of California's greenhouse gases. Can you explain that variation? 40% of the United States greenhouse gas emissions are from buildings, but only a quarter of California's. Is California significantly different from other parts of the nation, or what's going on there?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if this explains the entire gap, but a big reason is that in California, a huge portion of our emissions is attributed to transportation. I mean, California is just a large state, really car dependent, lots of vehicle miles traveled. So the transportation sector takes up a large portion of emissions here. I think thanks in part to the excellent energy efficiency codes that California has, some of the leading ones in the nation. Our energy efficiency usage in buildings is actually pretty good. And the electricity sector in California is on its way to 100% renewable energy. So the electricity we use in our buildings is also relatively low carbon, and it's getting cleaner every year. It's really the 12% of emissions from buildings that come from gas use, which is, again, for heating, hot water, and cooking, that we haven't done a good job of touching. And in fact, every year that we build new buildings, those emissions are going up because we're adding more gas usage.
And what are those emissions for those of us who are not familiar with this whole topic? I mean, we're talking about burning gas and we're talking about fossil fuels, but like what actually gets emitted when we use, say, our gas stove or use gas to heat?
From a climate perspective, when you burn gas, you're emitting CO2, carbon dioxide. And that is, you know, the pollutant I think most people are really familiar with. And sometimes, you know, back in the 90s, especially, people would say, oh, well, gas has less CO2 than coal or oil when it's burned. It's lower carbon, which is, you know, to be fair, that is true. But it doesn't capture all the emissions from gas because gas itself is methane, and methane is a super pollutant. It's a much stronger global warming pollutant than carbon dioxide. And by that, I mean it traps heat more effectively. So it's worse for our climate over the short time that it lives in the atmosphere. The problem there is not when it's burned, but when it's leaked. So before gas even reaches you and before you even burn it to cook or to heat anything, it's leaking throughout the pipeline system. It's leaking at pilot holes and just compressors and all along the infrastructure. And when it leaks into the atmosphere, the life cycle emissions and the climate impacts of gas are a lot worse, and sometimes they can outweigh the pollution impacts from coal and oil, even depending on how you calculate it. Now, that's for the climate side. Of course, there's also the air pollution impacts of burning gas, and especially the important impacts of burning gas indoors, burning them inside homes near to where people live. When you burn gas, you release NOx emissions, which is a precursor to smog. You release carbon monoxide, which is a criteria pollutant and toxic for people, and sometimes formaldehyde, pneumonia. And so it depends sort of on the exact type of appliance you're using and the type of gas burn. But overall, gas releases lots of emissions that are, you know, particulates and toxic air pollution that's really unhealthy for people to breathe indoors.
One of the reasons why I wanted to have this conversation is because San Francisco is grappling with an issue right now where a local reporter from Mission Local revealed that there may be a problem with potentially thousands of buildings having their gas lines encased in concrete during the course of seismic retrofits, which in an effort to address one safety issue with earthquakes may have created another one. I'm hoping that you could talk a little bit about what the dangers to people are of having gas lines in homes, because the obvious one that comes up there is fire. Is there any others that we should be thinking about?
I think fire is a really important risk for people to understand, fire and explosion, because this is an outcome of normalizing piping combustible fossil fuels all throughout our neighborhoods, underground and into our homes and schools and places of work, because California is extremely earthquake prone. And the number one cause of fires after earthquakes is ruptured gas lines. So it's a huge hazard, and they're really close to, you know, where people live, because that's where you have the most gas infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And a lot of this infrastructure was laid ages ago, and the rate of pipeline replacement and safety improvements is sort of being outpaced by the rate of gas line failure at least according to the Pipeline Hazard Safety Administration, the data shows that the number of fatalities and the number of injuries caused by gas explosions and gas pipeline explosions is higher than the rate of our replacement. It keeps going up every year. So we know it's a huge problem for our communities, just in terms of safety, leaving aside the emissions.
Can you say more about that? I'm interested in this data. How do you compare those two rather different numbers, a rate of injury versus a rate of replacement?
The main point is that even though the rate of pipeline replacement is going up, the rate of fatalities and injuries, which has to be reported by the Pipeline Hazard Safety Administration, has been increasing faster. So that's just a way of indicating to us that, you know, the safety risks associated with gas pipelines are large and growing, and they're not being resolved by, you know, our best efforts to replace the pipelines, because it's just all aging so fast. And I think the important thing to note is that they've jeopardized our communities entirely, whether it's workers or first responders, or it's just the residents of buildings or the people working in buildings. I mean, we just saw in Ventura County, an entire neighborhood in Southern California have to be evacuated due to this emergency from a compressor station, a gas compressor station. Mm. And Southern California, you know, has the famous Aliso Canyon gas leak, where a gas leak that released over 100,000 tons of methane into the atmosphere, one of the most significant environmental disasters in California's history, resulted in having to evacuate entire neighborhoods there as well. So it's a huge risk.
I'm also interested in talking a bit about the apparent connections to longer term risks. The report also indicates that kids who grew up in households with a gas stove are more likely to develop asthma. And you know, being more likely is one thing. It doesn't necessarily imply a direct causal relationship. But I'm curious if you could maybe talk a little bit more about the what health issues having gas and burning gas in a home is associated with that we know of.
I should start by saying I'm not a health professional. I'm not a nurse. Yes. So I don't know all of this stuff exactly.
You're not a doctor.
Right.
Yep.
But a lot more research has come out recently about the harms of pollution, air pollution in general, and especially of indoor air pollution associated with gas burning indoors. The primary source of that combustion inside the home is gas stoves. So when you're cooking with a gas stove, you're causing a huge spike of emissions of nitrogen dioxide and carbon monoxide. And when we measured this level of pollution outside, we recognized that it's illegal. I mean, it would exceed EPA standards, but we regularly subject ourselves and our families to this level of pollution inside our homes when we're cooking with gas stoves, which is a huge risk because you're kind of standing right over the pollution. You're often in a place where there's not a huge, you know, not great source of ventilation. It's a small area. Some folks have vents, but not everyone uses their vents. A lot of people, even when they do use their vents, are not using them properly. So the emissions there have a high impact, and they have an especially high impact for children because, sort of, for several reasons. Basically, children's lungs are still developing. The size of their lungs relative to their smaller body size means they're more vulnerable. And I think this might actually be part of it too, is that they're lower to the ground and closer to the source of the emissions. Mm-hmm. So more pollution settles. And again, lower income families and folks who, you know, live in housing that's have less clean appliances, poorer vents, and smaller kitchens are more likely to have increased exposure. We've seen in the data, and Rocky Mountain Institute is an organization that's done a lot of this research, has shown that low-income communities and communities of color are disproportionately impacted by the exposure from gas stoves. Hmm.
What can be done about that? Because we've talked previously about sort of that new buildings are increasingly not being built with gas lines, but we have all this old infrastructure, and it takes investment to replace old infrastructure and old appliances with electric ones. And that seems like it's always something that conflicts with, you know, financial interests of people who are for running housing where low-income people live. And also, you can't put that cost on people who already are struggling to pay their bills.
Totally. Yeah. The upfront costs of retrofitting are a big pain, and they're definitely a huge barrier. But this is why it's really important that at the end of the useful life of appliances, especially like heaters and gas stoves, that we're not replacing those appliances with yet another piece of fossil fuel infrastructure, that we're taking that opportunity to swap towards modern, electric, pollution-free options. There's no doubt that electrifying our buildings is going to be an important part of tackling this health crisis and our climate crisis, doing sort of both at the same time. And I think what that really takes is for decision makers and policymakers to value climate and health the same way we value sort of like upfront dollar costs, because we need to take better account of how much the status quo is actually costing us. And I think once you start to look at it that way, you see, okay, well, there are still significant challenges to financing the upfront costs, but we need to make sure that there are tools available to help people achieve funding. Like I said, at the end of the useful life of an appliance, when you're buying a new thing anyway, you should try to see if you can switch to an electric appliance. There's still barriers, because a lot of times you need panel upgrades to make sure that your house can actually sustain the amount of electric mm-hmm. power needed. And so it's going to take a lot of coordinated support from local governments, state governments, and the federal government to make these retrofits possible. I think part of what happens is when you value these as job creation opportunities, as health opportunities, you start to see the benefits of this as an investment rather than just a cost. And sort of on a more practical level, I would say for folks that are interested and don't want to go through the hassle of like retrofitting and taking out their gas stove, you can buy induction hot plates. They're kind of all the rage right now. These ones you see in like cooking videos and stuff, that just you plug it into a normal outlet. And I've heard of a lot of folks sort of through like energy Twitter just buying these induction hot plates and setting them on top of their gas stoves. So they just like never use their gas stoves anymore. Induction hot plates only heat metal that they're in contact with. They don't create ambient heat by burning something in the air. So it's a lot more pleasant and a lot more manageable to be in a kitchen with an induction burner when there's a heat wave compared to a gas burner.
I'm speaking with Sasan Sadat, a research and policy analyst with Earth Justice. Having this conversation framed in this way, where we're talking about like piping fossil fuels into our homes and burning it indoors and creating pollution indoors and more than EPA standards, and framing this whole thing this way makes it seem like it is kind of crazy to be doing that, piping, you know, gas into our homes to burn it. You've talked about how that's normalized. How did that happen? Why do we think this is normal?
Well, I think for a long time, there was a question about whether we had a cheap and affordable alternative. I mean, I think for everyday people who don't think like in their day-to-day lives about climate change or air pollution, it's just the energy they use. It just sort of fades into the background.
Well, yeah, now, it was always there. When they moved in, it was there.
Exactly. Yeah. And now, I mean, I would say that a lot of folks in the environmental justice community have raised alarms for a long time about the crisis of air pollution, not just from their gas stoves, but from all of the environmental stressors and burdens that they live with, resulting in increased rates of asthma for their kids and for their families and communities, and increased rates of cancer and lung disease and skin problems and headaches and nausea and all the things that come from burning stuff. And now we have all these viable alternatives, but they still haven't gained traction at the speed and scale they need to, because still there's an awareness gap. And like we were just talking about, there is the barrier of upfront capital and the logistics of retrofitting existing buildings. But I think as we are starting to increase this awareness, you know, as more medical societies and doctors are talking about the health harms of fossil fuel burning, and more communities are becoming aware and the alternatives are becoming more affordable, what we're up against is also a gas industry that has gone to bat for making gas sort of like the energy system of the new era for a long time, and is not prepared to let those investments go unamortized, is not ready to let those investments be stranded. And so they have a very active financial interest in continuing and abetting our reliance on gas infrastructure. And recently, we've seen really excellent work by journalists to uncover how the marketing behind these gas industry tactics has sort of tried to make gas stoves seem chic, make them seem, you know, classy, make the food taste better. And I think the reason that they've really focused on the stove is because they know that people don't really care at all about what they use for their heat in their homes and what they use to heat their hot water. That stuff is invisible. But the thing you cook with, you know, it's the one you interact with the most personally and face to face. And so they think if we can get people to feel attachment to their gas stoves, then they might be opposed to climate action. They might be opposed to a healthier option for their families. And they've latched onto that as a way to ward off the transition at the speed and scale we need.
Yeah, Mother Jones had a long story about this, and Earth Justice has reported on this too. I mean, this goes all the way to gas companies engaging people to post as concerned neighbors on neighborhood forums talking about, oh, no, they're going to ban gas lines and restrict this, you know, restrict it in new construction. They're going to take our stoves away. I wonder if you have any thoughts about why that works so well.
It's a good question. And, you know, I don't know if I think it works so
well. Maybe it doesn't,
I would say that we've had a lot of success by an active and engaged citizenry here in California where the fight has really already taken hold. And I think once people see the facts and the merits for themselves, this state, you know, people care a lot about climate action. They care a lot about the health of their families, like everywhere in the country.
Right.
And so when they learn the facts about this, I think most people realize like, oh, we could get something better for ourselves. We could get something that's lower cost, that doesn't put all these health harms on our families and our lungs, and doesn't burn the planet. But I do think it's really important, just as an initial point, to say that like none of the measures that have passed so far will make anyone get rid of their gas stove. Like no one is going to come into your house in the dead of night and steal your gas stove. Right. It's ridiculous. I mean, it's total fear-mongering because no one who's doing what they're doing now has to change anything for these laws. Like the only person that has to change anything are builders. And builders can actually save money by building without gas infrastructure, by avoiding the pipeline. So it's just new construction. It's just stopping us from digging this hole deeper. No one is going to force you to change. Now, they are right. Eventually, the vision we have for a future is one where we don't burn stuff to stay warm or to heat our food. And I think eventually most people will want this for themselves. And we'll want to make sure it's easy enough for everyone to do that.
I want to talk about one alternative. We had talked about alternatives. And one thing where I think that maybe the industry has been quite active in shaping the narrative is something called fossil gas alternatives, which is often referred to as renewable natural gas. And I'm curious what you make of that term, renewable natural gas. I mean, the advantage that is put forward on this is that existing infrastructure could be used to pipe this in. We don't have to do any retrofits. But is it really renewable?
Yeah, great question. So this is really the subject of our report that we did with Sierra Club, where we sort of dug into the merits of this claim that the industry had been throwing around a lot. Not just in California, but now kind of across the country, that the thing to do instead of addressing our building emissions and the health crisis that we talked about is rather than focus on electrifying these end uses is to just to pipe in a different gas. So not fracked gas, but gas from manure lagoons at factory farms or gas from landfills and wastewater treatment plants. So these sources of alternatives to fracked gas are like, typically in California, folks focus on animal manure lagoons from factory farms, which generate a ton of methane. Landfills generate a ton of methane, wastewater treatment plants. And these sources, or you can actually even create methane intentionally by gasifying woody waste material or energy crops, like things that you grow for the specific purpose of turning into gas. The big problem with all of these sources, well, there are many problems. I would like to take them in turn, but I guess I would say even if you set aside all the environmental or social questions around their integrity, let's say you accept that they were all very clean and very, like, you know, environmentally beneficial, there's probably about 4% of this gas that could displace our current fossil fuel combustion.
Oh.
So the initial vision that the gas industry markets of, oh, we'll keep the exact same sized infrastructure unplug the fossil gas and plug in the renewable gas and your life can go on as usual. Nothing needs to change. That is a fiction. That can't happen because we just don't have anywhere close to the amount, to the volume of sustainable gases available. So just sort of from that point of view, it's not even a possible vision.
Well, that's disheartening. But I want to emphasize something and have you just clarify something that the first time I heard this just blew my mind, which is that what renewable gas or these alternative gases in this case are is taking pollution that we're already producing and using that as natural gas. It's like taking emissions that are already a problem because they're methane, if I'm understanding this right, and piping them into our homes to combust.
This is a really critical point. I'm really glad you brought it up because the way that the industry will market it is to say we're capturing pollution and then using it to displace fossil gas. So it's a win-win. It's like not only are we avoiding emissions that are going into the atmosphere, but we're using them to displace fossil fuels. This is an awesome solution. It's carbon negative. They usually calculate it as negative emissions because they say essentially we're avoiding all this emissions going into the atmosphere. All these emissions going into the atmosphere.
And but we don't have to frack anything, therefore it's better overall.
The problem is that it doesn't... Right. The problem is it doesn't acknowledge how these emissions came to be. Like, are they the result of unavoidable things? Maybe, you know, with the case of landfills, like wastewater treatment plants. These are things society needs. If we can manage our waste and our resources better to reduce that pollution, that's great. The parts of it that are completely unavoidable, sure, let's capture it and maybe try to put it to beneficial uses. Other ones like factory farm CAFOs, you know, the way that we raise animals and livestock for centuries did not generate this massive amount of manure methane. That's a relatively recent phenomenon that comes from the profit maximizing tactic of placing as many animals in a single herd on one piece of land so much that can't be managed without flushing them into big manure pits. And that's what you see sort of from the biggest players. That causes the methane. And that methane is now being marketed as an environmentally beneficial and green thing when it could have been avoided in the first place by more sustainable farming practices. So we're essentially rewarding these polluters for a livestock management practice that is causing not only methane and greenhouse gas pollution, but also water pollution for local communities, air pollution, odor concerns, and it's altogether an irresponsible way to raise animals and to raise dairy that hasn't always been how we've done it, and we have alternatives that are much preferable.
So when we hear that this method is carbon negative, what you're describing is the greater context that makes that not make sense. Is it even technically correct? Does it produce fewer emissions than fracking?
Well, it's lower emissions than fracking in the sense that instead of releasing fossil fuels that have been buried underground for centuries and like letting that carbon escape into the atmosphere, it's taking the methane that we are emitting already through our farming practices. But the best way to manage that, of course, is to prevent the creation of the methane in the first place by using more responsible farming practices, mm-hmm. which, you know, for example, pasture-raised dairies, the cows themselves still produce methane, which is unavoidable, but the manure decomposes aerobically, naturally incorporates into the land and doesn't produce much methane at all. So there are alternative ways of managing this. And then I think to sort of move back to the other point is that even if you substitute this for gas, you're still getting all the air pollution and all the health harms that come with it. Mm. So this new gas, which there's already not even enough of, let's say it were environmentally friendly to capture and use, like it would still only displace about 4% of our fossil gas.
Yeah.
It would cost a whole heck of a lot more. And all for what? To like keep burning stuff near where we live and into our lungs? Like, why don't we just electrify these end uses and eliminate the need for gas burning altogether?
Well, good. I'm glad that you asked that. I'm going to ask it back at you. Why don't we? Is our electrical, you know, infrastructure and our energy production up to the task of replacing all of the energy in our buildings that is currently sourced from gas?
Yeah, I mean, I think transitioning all of our heating demand to electricity it's not going to be a massive increase in the amount of electricity we use. I mean, overall, our grid will have to become a lot stronger and we will have to generate a lot more clean and renewable electricity to make up for the deficit of fossil fuels that we retire and to be able to power more things with electricity. So we are thinking about wanting to have a larger electricity generation, you know, more electricity generation, and making sure that electricity generation is actually renewable. And that's the task that California is on and the country is on, and ultimately that the world needs to do. But the good news is electric end uses are a lot more efficient. So the actual energy usage of an electric appliance is lower than a gas appliance. And I think this is an important piece for people to understand that our heating systems, for example, using gas to heat the space in our homes, that process right now using gas boilers is so much, and gas furnaces, is so much less efficient than using modern electric heat pumps, which can, rather than burning stuff to create heat, basically work like a refrigerator in reverse. They just move ambient heat from the atmosphere to where you want it. And so you get a lot more heat for the given electricity. And even if a heat pump were more expensive, you get paid off much faster because of the high efficiency of heat pumps. So most people end up saving money on their utility bills, even if electricity is more expensive in your area, because it uses so much less energy.
Wow. Well, like so many climate issues, this seems like one of those things where collective action is necessary and more powerful than individual, and, you know, systemic change needs to happen. But are there things that end consumers can or should do to reduce the pollution, both indoor and outdoor, that they're producing in their homes?
Yeah, well, like you said, collective action is most important. So I think the first thing they should do is check whether their city has halted the expansion of gas in new buildings. And if they haven't, ask their city council members and their mayor to take that task on. Almost 40 cities across California have done that. And if you want to take it a step further, don't just ask your city, ask the state, ask, you know, the California Energy Commission, which sets the code for new construction of the energy code for new construction for all new buildings in the state, and urge them to set a code that would end the expansion of fossil fuels in new buildings. That's sort of the best thing I think people as individuals can do. Besides that, I think it's important for people to just get the word out to their community members, to look into replacing their appliances with electric appliances at the end of the useful life of those appliances. So when your gas water heater burns out, or your gas boiler you know, knocks out, try to see if you can replace it with an electric one, and look to see if your local utility has incentive programs to help offset the upfront costs, because often they will. And the final thing I'd say is that I know at the Berkeley Public Library, where I live, the Tool Library, they have induction plates. So if you don't want to buy one, you can like rent one out and just try it and take it for a whirl. I'm sure San Francisco has comparable programs, and they're pretty cheap to order or get at like most electronic stores or sometimes cooking stores. So I would take a look and see if you can take an electric or an induction burner out for a whirl. It might just change the way you think about cooking during the summer.
Sasan, thank you so much for returning again and for breaking this all down for me.
Yeah, thank you so much, Laura.
That was Sasan Sadat, a research and policy analyst with Earth Justice. I'm Laura Wenis, and you've been listening to Civic. Before I let you go today, at the Public Press, which is Civic's parent organization, we've been working really hard during this pandemic to pursue angles we're not seeing much coverage of elsewhere, or to take a more systemic look at the issues that are surfacing in the headlines. The San Francisco Public Press is a nonprofit, and we're inspired by the public radio model. That's the idea that people who are able to support the work that we do so everyone can have access to it without paywalls or ads. If you think we're onto something, we'd very much appreciate if you could show your support. You can do that by going to sfpublicpress.org/donate, or by helping us get the word out about this show. Subscribe on whichever podcast platform you use, or leave us a review. It really does help, so thank you.